There we go. Thank you. Okay, we're going to have a little bit of an introduction here this evening due to the nature of the upcoming material. We're going to try to get through four chapters this evening, so I recognize that that's just an awful lot of material, but you'll discover rather quickly that it is of a particular nature. We're digging on down into the minutiae, but not meaning any disrespect, of course, of this material. Truly does become somewhat tedious. And again, that's no reflection on the material itself, but we do not live under the old law. We do not have a Levitical priesthood. This book is not quite, but almost exclusively for those priests. All of that was a long time ago, and a fair amount of it, even as we'll see, maybe somewhat surprisingly here this evening, deals with things that we don't even know today precisely what they were. And so we are at such a distance that I'm not going to choose to spend a whole lot of time on individual parts of it. Hopefully we'll finish these four chapters then. What we've seen so far, you're used to this outline now, is that the first seven chapters all go together. There are five very primary sacrifices which are described at some length in those seven chapters. We covered those some weeks ago. Then in verses 8 through 10, we have the inauguration of the priesthood. You have a narrative section that tells you the history of what went through, what the priests went through in order to be sanctified and then to begin their actual service as priests. Then, of course, we mentioned in chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu refused to do as God would have them do and paid with their lives. So God has now demonstrated how serious he is about things being done exactly his way. He's not going to allow anybody to tell him how his religion ought to be practiced. And so Nadab and Abihu, right off the bat, much like Ananias and Sapphira, then set the record straight for everybody to appreciate. We serve God, and he's not changing his ways. We need to adapt to them. Now, in chapters 11 through 15, we are distinguishing between things that are clean and unclean. And in chapter 16, you'll have a chapter that kind of stands out uniquely on the Day of Atonement. And then we'll finish out the book, chapter 17 through 26, with a wide variety of things that have to do with holiness. But now, if we go back to these chapters 11 through 15, last week we covered in chapter 11 those dietary requirements. This week, hopefully tonight, we'll look at chapter 12. The 12th chapter deals with childbirth requirements. The 13th and the 14th chapter deals with what is in general, is one very large title, deals with leprosy. And then in chapter 15, everybody's favorite chapter, we deal with bodily fluids. Okay, and throughout all of this now, we are, I hope, able to remember what I spent a lot of time on last week. That with the dietary requirements, and we're surely about to see as well with all these four chapters we'll cover tonight, but on those requirements, the foods themselves were clean, I believe always clean, in the sense that there's no moral law that's broken if you eat one of these. It's not inherently a sinful thing or an evil thing, but that God established these to set the people apart from the Gentiles. So they're not evil or wicked or immoral or sinful in themselves. But for the 1500 years of the law, and only for the Jews, not the Gentiles, you know, so for a very small part of the world's population, not the majority, these foods had been set apart to designate the Jews as different from so many others. But here are tonight's topics: childbirth, swelling, scabs, spots, infections, including boils, leprosy, marks, and bodily discharges. So what a fun night we're going to have. Okay, this is everything we're talking about here. And as a matter of fact, you know, immediately I know how you react. There's sort of a technical term you can see there for what we're dealing with. The scientific category is icky. It's just stuff that's naturally kind of revolting and disgusting. And so you say, yuck. It's the kind of stuff we wouldn't want to deal with if we didn't have to. And how grateful we are that there are doctors today that can deal with such things, you know, so that we could just go there, get fixed, and come back away from it. But again, look at the list. Is there anything here that is inherently wrong, evil, immoral, sinful? Well, certainly not. These are things that will make you unclean, just like the foods would make you unclean. These things are going to require a certain amount of quarantine. They're going to require sacrifices. You know, they're big deals in God's mind. But it's God Himself that established having children. It's God Himself that said we are supposed to populate the world. It's God Himself who says you're blessed if you're married and your quiver is full of many children. And so hardly, when we start reading about these uncleanlinesses that go along with this, are we to think that the thing in and of itself God views as being some violation of cosmic law. That's not so. He has some other kinds of purposes, much of the time that we don't even know what they are now, that lie behind declaring these certain relationships as unclean. Now, as a matter of fact, at least seven of these things that we're going to be talking about, these eight that we're talking about tonight, are totally involuntary. And even with childbirth, you say, well, yeah, it's a voluntary thing. Well, yeah, true, but sometimes people are raped, and those women do have babies, and they'll be just as unclean when they give birth to that baby as if they were happily married. But, you know, she didn't want to have the child in that case. And so how could these things be inherently evil if you don't even have any control over them? It's not a choice. It's not a decision. It's not yea or nay, I want to serve my God. So now, with all that said, we won't have any more charts tonight. In fact, I'm just going to walk over here and turn the screen off. And so what we're going to do tonight now is just go rapidly through portions of the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th chapters. However, if you'd like to get out your pen or pencil, your highlighter, and do some general marking, I will identify for you each of these various sections. So it is helpful in later studies. Something may crop up for whatever reason. You'll say, you know, where's thus and such? Well, there's always concordances. But if you'll highlight these things the way I'll suggest, you'll instantly be able to reference them when you come over and, you know, when each section begins and ends. So we're going to start here in chapter 12 and verse 1. Remember, it's just immediately after the dietary laws. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the sons of Israel saying, when a woman gives birth and bears a male, then she shall be unclean for 7 days. So we would say she'll be unclean for a week. 1 week, 7 days. If it is a boy child. And then for 7 days, as in the days of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. On the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Then she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days. So unclean for 7, and then remains in this condition for 33. She shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for how long? And relatively how long? Twice as long as if it was a boy child, as in her menstruation, and she shall remain in the blood of her purification for how long? 66 days, which relatively is what? Twice as long. So, if she gives birth to a boy, 7 and 33, she gives birth to a girl, then 14 and 66. It's twice as much impurity. Verse 6, when the days for purification are completed, for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the doorway of the tent of meeting a 1-year-old lamb for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a what? A sin offering. We're going to have some fun there in just a minute. Now come back to verse 7. Then he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her. She shall be cleansed from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, whether male or female. But if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take two turtle doves or two young pigeons, the one for a burnt offering, the other for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement for her, and she shall be what? Oh, doesn't your translation say forgiven? Well, of course not, because no translation says forgiven. Does she need to be forgiven of anything? There's been no choice. There's been no wrong committed. Not in that sense. So, looking at verse 8, though, that's pretty famous. We all know that verse. Why do we know that verse? In the New Testament, Joseph and Mary, we demonstrate to be poor in this manner because of the sacrifice that takes place there. So, let's go back now and just note first, it's twice as much uncleanliness, it's twice as much impurity, it's twice as long that you're in this impurity, and so it's really pretty serious. You should never want to give birth to what? What is the deal? A boy, a week and 33. A girl, 2 weeks and 66. What's the deal?
Girls are more important.
I wish I had those hearing aids in. Or maybe I'm glad I don't. I'm not sure which there, but I missed that one. Anyway, you know what? So somebody tell me, what do you think's going on there? Is this a statement about the baby? The mother? What's it a statement about, do you suppose? Now, here's the good news. Does God ever tell us? Well, no. Oh, great. So, here's this impartial God, right? Never shows respect for anybody, you know, overly or specially. And now we have this gargantuan difference here. Kara, what do you think? Carol asks very diplomatically if it's related to Genesis 3. That's the only answer, brethren, that I could come up with, or I think that anybody else can come up with. Surely God, throughout His Bible, values men and women equally, values them equally. There's no difference in the redemption price for men and women, which is what? The death of Jesus on the cross. There's specific statements that are made about the equality of men and women in God's sight as their value is established. They are equally precious, equally important, equally beloved, no difference whatsoever. But what is certainly apparent throughout your Bible, both Old Testament and New, and what is, of course, particularly despised in our culture today, is that God not only recognizes the differences both physically and I think emotionally, mentally as well, between men and women, but He recognizes Genesis 3. He established in Genesis 3 something that we can weep and lament and call it unfair and all the rest of that if you want, but it is a major moment in world history, and it sounds like this. So hold the Leviticus. We'll be back here in just a moment. But come on over to Genesis chapter 3. We're going to look now at the punishments. You know the story. But we're just going to pick out the salient part here. So we're going back to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, but no other woman. See it again? Of course not. When he says you, he means you and your kind throughout all of time. Women will have much more pain in childbirth than they would have if Eve, you hadn't done this. Yet, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. This is a profound moment in world history. Now, we mentioned this before, had occasion not so long ago, to point out that while Eve did sin, and her sin precedes Adam's, what do we learn when Paul writes Timothy? That Adam was not deceived. And therefore, there's a big difference between those two sins. And God then, in Romans, is going to charge Adam with the first sin and not Eve, because he made a fully conscious and understanding decision to commit that sin. Now, Eve sinned, but she had been fooled. She'd been tricked. And so she's going to be punished. There's going to be, you know, this Genesis 3:16 punishment for her and for all women after her. And then there will be different responsibilities for men as opposed to women throughout both the Old Testament and the New. This is God's sovereign judgment on the way things ought to be as a result of the first sin, and then, as I understand it, the nature of the difference between men and women, and also then the curse that comes because of sin. Now, Adam sinned. Why do I have to work by the sweat of my brow? And here's a good question for you. Why would Jesus, as a boy working with his dad, growing up till 30, have to sweat by his brow? He never sinned, but he is what? Human. I have sinned. We ought to suffer for our own sins, but even Jesus, as a human being, is carrying, you know, doesn't the earth still grow thorns and weeds? For everybody. So when God establishes a curse like that, it is just, it is fair. We commit a terrible sin. We start second-guessing Him, trying to accuse Him of some kind of a crime. It'll all be revealed to us, I suppose, in one day, why this is so preeminently right and unchangeable. Carol, I think you're absolutely right. There isn't any other explanation or reason I know of that this would be the case. So with each birth, we have a very poignant, powerful remembrance of what happened in the garden and the consequences, how far-reaching those consequences are. And the fact that sin, while it can, and I suppose often is, very limited to the actual committer of the deed. And maybe nobody else ever knows, and you're the only one that are going to pay the consequences for it. But often, and throughout all of history, sometimes in the most terrible ways, will other people suffer, innocent people suffer, because of somebody else's sin? Of course they do. You know, think of Jeremiah, you know, thrown in his pit, hauled off into Egypt, where he had prophesied that these people ought not to turn for help and go. And what's he want to do with going to Egypt? They haul him down there anyway. You know, well, the whole nation is suffering. And even this upright, righteous prophet. So, brother, we just accept what God did was right and just and proper and good, and says absolutely nothing about value between men and women. It does, however, say a lot about the differing nature and responsibilities between men and women, and the difference in the curse that is following down through all of time because we are born of Adam and Eve. Carol.
I'm just thinking here, the way that the garden was constructed, I mean, they didn't have to work when they were in the garden. So they didn't have mosquitoes and ticks and all of those other things and the diseases. But the diseases were always out in the world. And so because they rejected God, the curse was always out there, the diseases and stuff. And so the fact that they weren't walking with God meant they had to walk with the world, and meant they had to work by the sweat of their brow and have all of the things except for the childbirth pain increase.
Did that pump just come on behind me? Is that what that was?
Probably.
You have to have somebody look at the baptistry here. I heard the rumbling going on back there. I'm not sure I totally understood what you were saying, Carol, but in the garden, they did not have the consequences of the sin. Whether or not outside the garden those things were already taking place, if that's what you're referring to, I'm not sure about that. I don't think the scripture actually addresses that. So we always wonder, did it just mean they got thrown out into a world where those things happened, but they weren't living in it, or were those things created at that moment? I'd just say that's an unresolved, you know, question. But either way, they suffer the consequences of their sin. Okay, so chapter 12, you can go ahead and just highlight the whole chapter. It's only on one topic. It's about the uncleanness, about being defiled in childbirth. Now, why then, at the end of verse 6, is there a sin offering? Again, it's important for us to remember that, you know, we often just assume that we have a concept in our head and it must necessarily be correct. So somebody tell me, we've talked about this before, this is Hebrew, of course, but in the Greek, what is the word for sin? Hamartano, or hamartio, it takes a number of different forms. All right, sin. Is that a formal word that can only refer to your choosing to violate some law of God? No. So I always use the illustration. When the archer bends his bow, he releases his arrow, it misses the target. He has what in the Greek? He has sinned. He has missed the mark. Okay? Something is amiss. It's out of line. It's not on point. It's not on target. So, if you'll remember that, when you give birth, it is an icky thing. There's a whole lot of ick that goes with childbirth. I got to see the first one, not the second one. Okay, and so this, or be present, but this is the nature of the circumstances. Okay, and when you are in that state, would you say you're presentable? No, nobody wants. My daughter-in-law nearly killed me when I came in, to see our first grandchild, and I had a camera with me. No, you can't use that thing in here. Okay, I understand. We still be friends. I'll turn it off. Okay, so, but it's icky, and you're not presentable. You haven't chosen to do any wrong, but you're out of line, aren't you? You really don't fit anywhere else but right there. And then we got to fix it. We got to clean you up. This is the kind of missing the mark I think we're talking about. So don't get upset because the sin offering, I was belaboring it. There's no sin. There's no sin. There's no sin in the way we usually define the word, kind of almost in all capital letters, that it is some kind of moral failure. That's not the case at all. But when you're just out of sorts, and the priests get in this condition a lot, then it needs to be cleansed, set right, and then you can go back to your regular duties and responsibilities. Okay, so now we're going to take chapter 13 and 14 all in one big chunk. And as you notice there, it's huge. There's 59 verses in chapter 13. You come to chapter 14 and there's 57 verses in chapter 14. But just at the top of chapter 13, make your note. Chapters 13 and 14 on leprosy. And if I were you, I'd put it in quotes, leprosy. Because the first and maybe foremost, most important thing to know about these two chapters is that what we call leprosy today is apparently not found in either one of these two chapters. What is being described here is very different than what we call leprosy today. So once again, and kind of like the sin offering over here, you just kind of have to tear all those thoughts out of your head. Near as I can tell, as I do my studies, nobody has a clue in 13 and 14 what we're even talking about. Because apparently, this doesn't even exist on the earth anymore. And so, some of the commentators have suggested, this was something that God did, you know, as a sovereign act on His own and has ceased to do. But it's just another one of those things, brother. Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to God, but the things that are revealed to us and our children, and we just don't know, you know, about this. But did the Levites know about it? Were the Jews at that time and in that country experiencing these things? Yes, they were. So now we'll just start reading a big chunk of the 13th chapter, and then we'll just kind of pass on the rest. But start with verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When a man has on the skin of his body a swelling or a scab or a bright spot, and it becomes an infection of leprosy on the skin of his body, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons the priests. The priest shall look at the mark on the skin of the body, and if the hair in the infection has turned white and the infection appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is an infection of leprosy. When the priest has looked at him, he shall pronounce him what? Unclean. Remember the word. But if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body, it does not appear to be deeper than the skin, and the hair on it has not turned white, then the priest shall isolate him who has the infection." Isolate. What's our Q word for that? Quarantine. But for how long? 7 days. "The priest shall look at him on the seventh day," verse 5, "and if in his eyes the infection has not changed," in the Levite's eyes, he doesn't see any change, "the infection has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall isolate him for 7 more days. And the priest shall look at him again on the seventh day." I wish they'd put the second seventh day or the 14th day, but that's what it means in verse 6. "And if the infection has faded and the mark has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It is a scab. And he shall wash his clothes and be clean. But if the scab spreads farther on the skin, after he shows himself to the priest for his cleansing, he shall appear again to the priest. The priest shall look, and if the scab is spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is leprosy. When the infection of leprosy is on a man, then he shall be brought to the priest. The priest shall then look, and if there's a white swelling in the skin, and it has turned the hair white, and there's a quick raw flesh in the swelling, it is a chronic leprosy on the skin of his body, and the priest shall pronounce him what? Unclean. But what is the next phrase? He shall not isolate him. Is he quarantined? Well, no. So, again, that's kind of surprising to us. And if we're thinking purely in terms, you know, of a medical condition, let's say, well, that's surprising. So here's this thing, and it's not going away, but it does not require a quarantine. Every time he is still what? Unclean, but not isolated. Now go to 12. "If the leprosy breaks out farther on the skin, and the leprosy covers all the skin of him who has the infection, from his head even to his feet, as far as the priest can see, then the priest shall look, and behold, if the leprosy has covered all his body, he shall pronounce him what? Clean, who has the infection. It has all turned white, and he's clean. But whenever raw flesh appears on him, he shall be unclean. Pronounce him unclean, and he shall pronounce him unclean. The raw flesh is unclean. It is leprosy. Or if the raw flesh turns again and is changed to white, then he shall come to the priest. The priest shall look at him. Behold, if the infection has turned to white, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. He who has the infection is clean." But at no point, brethren, were these people quarantined for more than what? 14 days. Okay? So, whatever this is, it's apparently not some super contagious thing, is it? No, you're just out in the general population there. Now look at 18. And so, at verse 2, if you like, you know, you could highlight a whole series of things in verse 2. What you've got is swelling, scab, bright spot, infection, and leprosy. Okay? So there's a lot of different descriptors there. Now watch at verse 18. When the body has a boil on its skin, and it is healed, and in the place of the boil there's a white swelling or a reddish-white bright spot, then it shall be shown to the priest. The priest shall look, and behold, if it appears to be lower than the skin, and the hair on it has turned white, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is the infection of leprosy. It has broken out in the boil. But if the priest looks at it, and behold, there are no white hairs in it, and it is not lower than the skin, and is faded, then the priest shall isolate him for 7 days. If it spreads farther on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is an infection. Now, a moment ago, make sure I get this straight. You know, they're never isolated for more than 14 days. But if the bright spot remains in its place, verse 23, and does not spread, it is only the scar of the boil, and the priest shall pronounce him clean. Are you getting bored yet? But I'm out of gas already, aren't you? Okay, go ahead.
Did the person who was unclean then have to say he was unclean when he was walking through?
No, that'll come up later, okay? But not in this class. Let's just highlight, you know, what we've got right here. In verse 24, if the body sustains in its skin a burn by fire, so just highlight burn by fire, because what then follows? The raw flesh of the burn becomes a bright spot, reddish white or white. The priest shall look at it. If the hair is bright spot, you see, here we go again. And so I just highlight, what if somebody gets burned? You can then have, though, what will be called an infection of leprosy. So we have the priest now involved in some very formal system of identifying skin diseases, whether they just crop up on their own or are the result of an injury, in this case, of a burn. Skip down to verse 38. When a man or a woman has bright spots on the skin of the body, white bright spots, then the priest shall look, and if the bright spots on the skin of their bodies are faint white, it is eczema that has broken out on the skin. He's what? He's clean. Eileen?
So would the priest the doctor?
I don't know. I don't know that I would call them doctors. You know, the question is, are they doctors? That conjures up in our minds, you know, we're doing treatments and we're going to take, you know, do this, do that, do this other thing. And it's not really quite like that. It's identification for the purposes of uncleanness. And then we watch it to see if you become clean. And if you do, then there are very elaborate procedures and sacrifices we'll see here in a minute that are to take place. But I'm not sure I would say they were doctors by any means. And yet, you know, it's like they are doing triage or something. You know, is that the word? You know, to identify it. So, you know, great mysteries in this material, and that's good, because then I just get to say, I don't know, and it's the end of the matter. You know, otherwise I have to learn something. But in this case, you know, there's just a lot of mysteries in this section here. Okay, so the next one, now all the guys are real concerned about this in verse 40. Just highlight the word bald. Okay, so if a man loses hair of his head, he's bald, and he is... Well, that's good news. You're not going to get kicked out of the congregation, you know, because you go bald. If his head becomes bald at the front and sides, he's bald on the forehead, he's clean. But if on the bald head or the bald forehead there occurs a reddish-white infection, it's leprosy breaking out, then the priest shall look at him, the swelling, the infection, reddish-white, and here we go again. Okay, so I'm not going to get into all of that. Now, something, though, that I find interesting, and once again, is apparently unknown in modern circumstances. is verses 47 to the end of the 13th chapter. When a garment has a mark of leprosy in it. Well, that's weird. Now you learn something about the term leprosy, though, don't you? We get to thinking about Catholic priests off on Molokai, you know, and that's just all wrong. It's a very general term, and it has to do with certain kinds of ickinesses in the skin. They can be raw, they can be white, it can be skin deep, and be this color, maybe that color, and you just got all this stuff going on. But now a garment has leprosy. How does a garment get leprosy? Whether it is a wool garment, continuing in 47, or a linen garment, whether in warp or woof, of linen or of wool, whether in leather or any article made of leather, if the mark is greenish or reddish in the garment or in the leather or in the warp or in the woof or in any article of leather, it is a leprous mark and shall be shown to the priest. Then the priest shall look at the mark, shall quarantine the article with the mark for 7 days. He'll then look at the mark on the 7th day if the mark is spread in the garment, and off we go again. It's kind of interesting, though, we get a new word at the end of verse 51. It's a leprous malignancy. A leprous malignancy, and it is unclean. So we have a thing, you know, that is malignant somehow, but what is it in? Your sweater.
Something that occurred to me some time ago when I was reading this. All these things where it occurs, including the walls of your house, are organic substances. They're not artificial like what we wear today.
I couldn't hear the last part, Bill.
Their clothing and their buildings were all organic substances. They weren't artificial like things we use today.
Well, okay. But there's an awful lot of stone, you know, and plaster and what I wouldn't think of as organic.
Dirt is what it's made out of, and that's organic as well.
Well, okay. But you're right. We do have some different substances and whatnot today, you know, for all of our building. We're still using wood. But what? Somebody tell me now, and I'm sure you did the same thing, you know, what does this maybe sound like that we do have today in the house, for instance? Immediately you would say mold or mildew and even the colors, and then it grows or it doesn't, and when you get to the houses you could lose your whole house if you know it can't be contained, if it can't be fixed. But it is a growing thing, as Bill's pointing out there, you know, and so maybe that's what this is in the garment thing, you know, something like that. And it can be in any kind of garment, leather. But just skip down to 57 and the consequence. If it appears again in the garment, whether in the warp or in the woof or in any article of leather, it's an outbreak. The article with the mark shall what? Be burned. So that's the end of that. You know, time to go shopping. You're going to have to do away with it, and you're going to have to burn it. So we're going to take great care to see that whatever this is, which is so difficult and impossible, I guess, for us to identify today, doesn't replicate. Okay, so let's go to chapter 14. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This shall be the law of the leper in the day of the cleansing. He shall be brought to the priest. The priest shall go out to the outside of the camp. Thus the priest shall look. If the infection of leprosy has been healed in the leper, then the priest shall give orders to take 2 live clean birds and cedar wood and a scarlet string and hyssop for the one who is to be cleansed. The priest shall also give orders to slay the one bird in an earthenware vessel over running water. As for the live bird, he shall take it, together with the cedar wood and the scarlet string and the hyssop." Hyssop is just a little plant. And you'll remember that it's a, you know, frilly is the word I want to use, you know, but when you dip it in blood, for instance, you can fling it, you know, it's easy to shake and splash. And so this is that same hyssop we read about with the priest. "But he shall dip them," and continuing in verse 6, using the hyssop, "shall dip them in the live bird in the blood of the bird that was slain over the running water. He shall then sprinkle 7 times the one who is to be cleansed from the leprosy, shall pronounce him clean, shall let the live bird go free over the open field. The one to be cleansed shall then wash his clothes, shave off all his hair, bathe in water, and be clean. Now afterward he may enter the camp, but he shall stay outside his tent for 7 days. It shall be on the seventh day that he shall shave off all of his hair. He shall shave his head and his beard and his eyebrows, even all his hair. He shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and be clean. Now on the eighth day, he is to take 2 male lambs without defect and a yearling ewe lamb without defect. Now at this point, this is becoming what? Expensive is what this is becoming. And 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering and 1 log of oil. The priest who pronounces him clean shall present the man to be cleansed, the foresaid, before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Then the priest shall take the 1 male lamb, bring it for a guilt offering with the log of oil, present them as a wave offering before the Lord. Next, he shall slaughter the male lamb in the place where they slaughter the sin offering and the burnt offering at the place of the sanctuary, for the guilt offering, like the sin offering, belongs to the priest. It's most holy. But we had a sin offering, now we got a guilt offering. What did the guy do? He caught a disease. So again, our sense of sin and guilt needs at least to be, you know, informed with the realization that these people were utterly helpless. They chose to do nothing. They certainly wouldn't want to do this ever, and it's going to cost them dearly for the sacrifices and time off from work and outside your tent and all the rest of that. You know, and so the skeptic just recoils in horror and immediately calls Jimmy Kimmel and all the rest of those guys at night, you know, to make fun of all those morons that would ever believe in the Bible. Now, brother, you see what I've been building on the last few weeks. That is an awfully elaborate procedure. Can you explain any of it? Running water, turn a bird loose, kill the other one, sprinkle him 7 times. What is it about? And you would say, I don't know. So is the only proper conclusion then, it's stupid? No. You've already declared your stupidity, your ignorance. You don't know. Why is it that the people who don't know what they're talking about are typically the most sure of what they're saying? That's amazing to me. So I don't know what was going on here. Why then is that foolish? Why then is it silly? Why then is it to be mocked and scorned? We don't know what we're talking about here. So all I can do is stand back and say, this is beyond my pay grade then. I don't know what God was doing. But it doesn't say one thing in the world about God, His existence, His wisdom, His power. It says nothing about whether or not one ought to believe in God. These are requirements for the Jews under the law about things we don't even have today. So what should we do? Admit our ignorance. I don't know. So if there's significance in the scarlet thread, you will never know what it was. We don't know. Might the Levites have known? Yeah. Could be that in that time, everything was explained in detail and it made perfect sense. Oh, of course, running water, turn that one loose. And it would all have symbolic importance that would just be so precious to these Jews. But is any of that given to us? No. More of the reasons why, when the Jews today, falsely so-called by a biblical definition, say, we're going to one day, you know, resurrect all the Old Testament sacrifices and everything. Can it be done? No, because they don't know any more about this than anybody else does. The time has passed. Carol?
Well, you got me thinking here. If God had them as a holy group of people set aside for Him, they should be holy because He was holy. And these icky things make them not holy. It's not that they're sinful, but they're unclean. So in order to get them clean again...
Yeah, and it's very elaborate cleaning and costly cleaning. So we can start speculating like everybody else. It is symbolic, a representative of sin, the high cost of sin and all that. But you know, they haven't done anything themselves that would be a moral failure, but it's emblematic. You know, but no, it's just pure speculation. We don't know what was going on there, so we just have to be content with that. Now, I've got only 10 minutes left, but I do want to finish this 15th chapter, and I think it'll be fine. The 15th chapter still has got 33 verses, so it's a pretty good-sized one. But it's also the ickiest of all of them. And so you go home, you read it. But I'm just going to start off, you know, and then pretty well drop the subject. But in 15:1 and following, the Lord also spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. Moreover, this shall be his uncleanness in his discharge. It is his uncleanness, whether his body allows its discharge to flow or whether his body obstructs its discharge. Every bed on which the person with the discharge lies becomes unclean. Everything on which he sits becomes unclean. Anyone, moreover, who touches his bed shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, be unclean until evening. Whoever sits on a thing on which the man with the discharge has been sitting shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and be unclean until evening. Whoever touches the person with the discharge shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Or if the man with a discharge spits on one who's clean," I think that'd make anybody unclean, whether he got this going on or not. "But he too shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Every saddle on which the person with the discharge rides becomes unclean. Whoever touches any of the things which were under him shall be unclean until evening. He who carries him shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Likewise, whomever the one with the discharge touches without having rinsed his hands in water shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, be unclean until evening. However, an earthenware vessel which the person with the discharge touches shall be broken, and every wooden vessel shall be rinsed in water." Now, brother, we've been through a lot of medical science since these days. It's not hard at all to speculate that we may be talking about everything so far in these four chapters having to do with preventing the spread of disease. I'm granting that is what we may be talking about. It seems extremely likely. But Eileen, are they doctors? See, I don't know, and I'm reluctant to want to say that. So remember, before last week's lesson, I had the guy from Harvard, you know, all his stuff, and he was talking about, people wonder why the dietary laws. What is the number one, far and away, most popular reason people think God gave the dietary laws? Hygiene. To keep people from getting sick and to have them live longer. Okay? But I showed you there's like four, five reasons why that isn't going to fly. It isn't really very reasonable or very defensible. It doesn't seem like really that's the case. And so, but again, there may be elements of these things involved. And when we're talking about this kind of stuff, you know, leprosies of various kinds, and now these discharges, sure, I'm willing to grant that God in his all wisdom had some of those ideas in mind as well. But does he say so? See, no. So I get left with, well, okay. These are, after all, the Jews. Theirs is, after all, an exquisitely complicated religion, all of which is going to go away after 1,500 years. But while it was in place, as my wife and her family used to say in Oklahoma long ago, boy, howdy, these people sure were separated. Boy, howdy they were. So I just learned to have, you know, what I think of as kind of a lighter touch on these things now. You could, if you want, spend the rest of your life studying these four chapters and be my guest. And maybe you will rightly solve the great puzzle of what the disease was and how it got into a garment and the reason why, you know, the running water, the scarlet thread, and, you know, the whole thing. But I don't think you're going to actually have much change in your life if you do. So if it has to do with medicine, great. We have those things universally around the planet now for medicinal reasons. Let's be healthy for medicinal reasons. But I once had a guy come up to me, and he was extremely excited. He had found... the word's eluding me now. What is the plant that you put on a burn? Aloe. He had found the word aloe in his Bible. And because he had found aloe in his Bible, it was like he thought God had sent him this secret health message. And so now he was buying aloe products and selling aloe products, and he was the grand missionary of all things aloe. Well, Brody, all right, I put aloe on my burns too, and it does seem to help. But I don't know that in that passage that mentions aloes, that that's necessarily what God had in mind. Could God not use aloes for different purposes? Sure he could. And could he use them with regard to cleanliness and uncleanliness in a ritual way for the Jews under the old religion? Yes, he could. Now, if only he'd explained it. But he hasn't. Now, I'm just going to read a couple so you have the highlights. I gave you, you know, the whole two chapters highlighted as leprosy. I showed you where the garment was in chapter 13. It was at verse 47. Okay, chapter 14 is all about leprosy, but it has to do with the cleansing. And it just goes on and on and on in the vein we just did. So I'm not going to read any more of that. It's just extremely elaborate, you know, to get to the cleansing. So, for your highlighting, and with one ear and one eye closed, you know, highlight in verse 1, when any man has a discharge, and then highlight in verse 16, if a man has a seminal emission, he shall bathe all his body in water, be unclean until evening. In verse 18, if a man lies with a woman so that there is a seminal emission. And then in verse 19, when a woman has a discharge, those are your, so far, each, maybe went too fast, is why I'm slowing down. You got to highlight verse 1, verse 16, verse 18, and verse 19. Then, 24, if a man actually lies with her so that her menstrual impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days. So there's another one you want to highlight. And lastly, verse 25. If a woman has a discharge of her blood many days, not at the period of her menstrual impurity, so there's yet another. These are the discharges that you're dealing with in Leviticus chapter 15. Now, we'll summarize and close out our class with verses 31 through 33, which I highlighted in a different color because you got a summary statement now. Thus you shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their cleanness. I'm sorry. I highlighted it in blue and lost a whole syllable there, didn't I? Thus you shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by their defiling my tabernacle that is among them. Is there anything there about dying because you shouldn't eat pork and it'll kill you? Is there anything about dying because you caught, you know, leprosy and it'll kill you? No, it's defiling my tabernacle. Ultimately, brethren, we've just read four chapters, and I think you ought to add the fifth chapter, 12, with the dietary requirements, or 11, I guess it was, with the dietary requirements. What are they about? 31 tells you. 31 is the magic key to all these five chapters, in my opinion. You shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their uncleanness, lest they die. This would be God killing them in their uncleanness by their defiling my tabernacle that is among them. This is the law for the one with a discharge, for the man who has a seminal emission so that he's unclean by it, for the woman who's ill because of her menstrual impurity, for the one who has a discharge, whether male or female, or a man who lies with an unclean woman. So, that 31st verse looks to me like it could pretty easily, and I think properly and rightly should be, applied to everything in chapter 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. Now see, it's in the context and limited to verse 15, in verses 32 and 33. I freely grant that. But I think what we've learned in these last couple of classes is that this is about God's religion, God's sacrificial system, God's tabernacle, how God relates to His people, how He separates them both from Himself and from the Gentiles, and not so much about hygiene, healthy foods, and how to avoid, you know, having mold in your house. I'm not sure those things are really so, you know, emphasized as verse 31 is. Okay, last comment or question? I can still hear the echo of the bell. Bob.
The whole point seems to me to be that you cannot go make sacrifice for sin until you are clean.
Absolutely. That's it.
Whether you just gave birth to a child, there's no sin involved in that. It's that you can't go in and make your sacrifice until you're clean, and that applies to the food all the way through all these things that we just...
I didn't think to say that at all. And I could have kept my mouth shut for 55 minutes and just let Bob say that, and you'd have it. Thank you, Bob. That's it. Somebody else had a hand up. You want to keep everybody? How long? Go ahead, Bill.
The sin offering for childbirth, was that only for girls or for both boys and girls?
I'm sorry, say again the first part, just the first part.
The sin offering for childbirth?
Yes.
Was that only for the girl babies or both for girls and boys?
I don't remember. You're going to have to go back and read it. I can't remember, Bill. I'm sorry.
Okay.